Dozer interviewing Bill Wald for the National Council of Jewish Women, Pittsburgh Chapter, Oral History 2, September 13th, 1993. Dr. Wald, could you say a few words just so we can make sure we can hear you?
Yes, it's good to see you again, and I hope there are no glitches this time and everything goes smoothly.
Dr. Wald, when we last met, we were talking about your clinical work at the various Pittsburgh hospitals. Is there anything else that you would like to add to that? We were talking about...
I don't remember what...
We were talking about... You were describing the studies on chromosomes and
genetics.
Oh,
yes, the clinical cytogenetics work. No, I think we talked about the applications, the development of the lab, and the spin-off of the intrauterine studies to McGee, and the genetic problems to children's, and the remainder of the cancer cytogenetics is what we do at Presby.
Dr. Wald, you certainly have had a very interesting and what I would think fulfilling career. Is there a special accomplishment or achievement that stands out in your mind or that you're the proudest of?
Well, I think one area was the development of cytogenetics as a research and diagnostic tool, which started from my work here at the university, and now it's obviously expanded far beyond what we were able to do at the beginning. The second, I think, was the development of the academic teaching program here at the university in radiation health. We have trained a large number of the people who are now the practitioners and leaders in the field of radiation protection, and it always feels as if this was worthwhile whenever I go to meetings or visit other universities and companies in the nuclear field to run into our alumni wherever I go. They are fulfilling a national need, and it's kind of nice to know that our program was one of the leading ones that develop the education in this field. So I guess I would put those two things as things I'm most happy about in looking backward. There have been individual, particular research projects that have been exciting, but these are more general things that I think I would consider useful accomplishments.
Have a major part of you in that. In retrospect, is there something you would have done differently? Or is there anything that you would have changed?
Well, I suppose, looking back, if I had known when I was starting out how much more effective it is to leave to chance the planning of, or the direction of one's career, I would have saved an awful lot of worry about what am I going to do and where am I going, because as it turned out, the various twists and turns were dictated by developments that I didn't control, but led to opportunities for me. And, you know, instead of assuming that I'd have to control the whole direction of my life, my work, would have been easier if I had known then that just relax and see what happens.
That's right.
Yeah.
Before you go on, you mentioned that there were some individual research projects that were exciting. Could you tell us, I assume there are things that you did on your own, and I think we'd like to hear that.
Well, one was a study that we, I and my colleagues in Japan carried out for the treatment of a hematologic disorder called polycythemia vera, which most simply is described as an overproduction of red blood cells. The time-honored treatment was the use of a radioactive isotope of phosphorus, P32. That treatment had been developed before the first atomic reactor. The isotope was produced by cyclotrons. In fact, the cyclotron here at the university under Alexander Allen's aegis was the national supplier for P32 for such treatment. P32 decays, loses half its activity in 8 days. We were off in Japan. By the time a shipment of P32 would come to us from Oak Ridge and would sit in customs and finally get down to Hiroshima, most of the activity was gone. And so we looked around for another approach, a chemotherapeutic approach, and it turned out to be effective without having the problems associated with the radioactive isotope that was being used up to then. And many better compounds were developed subsequently, but it was a good feeling to pioneer a new form of treatment, even though it was thrust upon us by the problems of our distance from the supplier. Another area that I remember was a research breakthrough in collaboration with Dr. Arthur Upton at Oak Ridge National Laboratory. Dr. Upton had developed a mouse model of a line of genetically pure mice that developed leukemia after radiation exposure, and the type they developed was that which humans develop. Most of the mouse leukemia is different from that induced by radiation in people, but this one matched, and I was doing the cytogenetics as part of the study, and we encountered a specific marker, an abnormal chromosome, which occurred in each mouse that developed the disease, and this matched a finding in a form of human leukemia, which helped to confirm that there was something very close relationship between the chromosomal abnormality and the disease. Unfortunately, we did this before some of the new techniques for chromosome painting were available that allow you to analyze in much more detail and to understand what's going on. And we weren't able to do that, but still it was a breakthrough of sorts, which doesn't happen very often. I remember that one in particular. The material I presented in Washington last Friday if it's confirmed what we did was a pilot analysis on our Ukrainian school children study, and it looks as if the population that had the increased eye abnormalities, which was an unexpected finding, because the environmental exposure was not supposed to be high enough to produce any such effect. It looks as if they also have an increase in chromosome abnormalities, which again is unexpected because of the supposedly relatively low level of exposure and the fallout from the Chernobyl accident. If it's substantiated when we finish the remaining two-thirds of the study, which we haven't yet, I think that will be quite an important finding for the welfare of the population in that area. It will at least suggest the need for close medical surveillance for other late effects of radiation exposure, such as cancer. So, but that's premature. We just took a look at the pilot results of the first 50 of the 150 samples we have. But it'll be interesting to see if it holds up.
And you're one of the main people working with this?
Again, we're doing the cytogenetics part of the study, which included medical and ophthalmological examinations in particular.
Unless you're thinking of something better.
No.
That you would like to tell us about, of your own projects.
No, that's about all that we have going on now. We're still working on automating the technique so it can be done on a larger scale basis. It took us to do the first 50 cases, took almost a year with the half-time help of a graduate student, and it's a pretty slow way to do research, but funding being what it is, that's all we could afford.
Are you moving into automating the techniques now?
Yeah, that's been something I started back in the 1960s. I was a bit naive. I was very naive about the field of computer science called image processing. And I didn't know when I started that what I was proposing to do represented new ground in the field of image processing. All I wanted was a system that would do my chromosome analysis faster. And as it turned out, a few graduate students in electrical engineering did their doctorates on the project, and it was very interesting for the engineers. They were interested in developing the system. I was interested in using it, and back then we never really got to the point where we could use it effectively because they were always tinkering and improving it and changing it. So it was a frustrating area of research because I didn't know enough engineering to do it myself. Or if I had, I probably wouldn't have gotten into it in the first place because it hadn't been done and I didn't realize. But I learned a lot about image processing, and we finally had to scrap our prototype microscope. We did have the first system which automatically would find the cells of interest. In order to look at chromosomes, the cell has to be in the process of division, and since only one or two in 100 are, it means you have to look through a lot of haystacks to find a few needles. So we had an automatic system that would find the dividing cells long before anyone else had developed it. But that wasn't enough to do my research, so we were working on the digitizing and analyzing the digital image with a computer. But the technology improved, our system became obsolete. More recently, in the 90s, we came back to the problem since it hadn't been solved, and by this time, the instrumentation was already on the market to find the dividing cells and to convert the microscope image to a computer image. Was the software, the programs that analyzed the cell were for a different purpose. They were for the clinical purpose of looking for abnormalities, matching up the pairs of chromosomes. They were not for looking at the radiation-induced kinds of damage. So I got into a collaboration with a group in Scotland, the British Medical Research Council unit, human genetics there, and we did develop software which we then could use on the commercial system. So I didn't have to be involved in the development of the instrumentation anymore. All I had to do was find the money, which was not any easier to do, I might say. But we finally got an instrument which we use in our clinical lab for the diagnostic purposes, in adult cytogenetics, and in the off hours we're using for our specific program that looks for the radiation-induced chromosome damage. And we've proven the system to be functional with blood cells radiated in the test tube. It's an experimental validation, and now we're going to use it on the Ukrainian school children study, in addition to scoring the cells the visual, time-honored way through the microscope. We'll do the same data set with the automatic system to validate or check out the validity of our automatic system. If it checks out as giving the same results, then we can apply the automatic system to other population studies. Hopefully, my objective back in the 60s hasn't changed. It's to monitor radiation workers biologically rather than by physical means using the thermoluminescent dosimeter, which is the method that's used now. And the objective always has been to look at the extent of biological impact of the work. The industry, of course, is only concerned with the exposure that it is responsible for, so that the same worker may have a lot of radiation exposure outside work, from radiologists, from dentists, from other sources. The industry doesn't count that, but the body's cells do, and my approach hopefully would be a way of biological monitoring, so that given a certain level of biologic effect, the worker could be removed from further exposure of any type until the repair processes that we all have catch up with the degree of damage. So that's the basis for the automation, and maybe we're getting there.
Yeah.
Dr. Wong, when you first entered medical school, you were thinking in terms of research from the very beginning.
Yes, I think that's true. I think I mentioned I read Paul de Kreef's book, Microbe Hunters, at a relatively young age, and that was exciting, and I thought that would be fun to do for a life work. Come quite a ways from microbes, but I think wanted to in an area where I could do research as well as clinical work. And I suppose I've done more research than I've done clinical work, although I tried to combine the two as long as I could. And I think to the extent that I did, it worked out reasonably well. I'm still using the clinical laboratory, which I'm involved in, and doing research with the same instrumentation. So it's, I guess I haven't left that approach. I hadn't thought about it, but it seems as if I've been consistent.
Dr. Bob, would you care to share information in terms of any honorariums or awards or honors, publications that have come your way?
No, publications are part of the everyday life. An academic, so I've got about 150 or so papers or chapters, that kind of thing. I did have the pleasure of serving as a visiting American professor in a program that the Royal Society of Medicine has been operating over in the United Kingdom. It's supported by Burroughs Wellcome. It turns out that Burroughs and Wellcome were British physicians, and I think one was a pharmacist, and they came over to this country, and the company's done pretty well over many, many decades. And the company established the funding for this visiting professorship, visiting American professorship at the Royal Society of Medicine, sort of a payback or something. And I was chosen one year by the section on occupational medicine, involved giving a number of seminars and visiting different institutions in Britain. And I guess that was an honor and a very interesting experience.
When was that?
In the 1980s, I've forgotten exactly which year. And, they put us up at the Royal Society of Medicine as a building of its own in London, in a very exclusive area. It was very pleasant.
You and your wife?
Yes. Yes.
How long were you there?
About a month. The terms of the professorship is no less than 3 weeks, no more than five. They they know exactly what they want, and it was a very nice period of time, and we traveled around to various places. We met some interesting people.
You know, as much information as you have shared with us, I have a feeling we're just scratching the surface.
Well,
am I right on that?
You're trying to cover professionally. I got out of, or got into medical school in 1944, so you're covering about 50 years in a few hours, so I suppose that's true, but I think we've hit the highlights. I mean, you know, there are a lot of experiences that were fascinating that I haven't, you know, as non-scientifically fascinating, or to see what an atom bomb burst looks like firsthand, many of them. And, or to work with the Russians, which, and the Ukrainians, working in the National Laboratory in East Tennessee was an experience. Just shifting around from, you know, 2 years in Texas and then 3 years in Japan and then a year in East Tennessee before Pittsburgh. I mean, these were all very interesting experiences.
The public recognize for some of these things with awards or such honors? Because you've done so much work in the field.
No, I don't know. I mean,
being
called on to advise various agencies, Nuclear Regulatory Commission, Department of Energy, these are the kinds of the kind of recognition that has meaning, and
right.
I don't look for publicity. I have a stepmother who is always disappointed in me because she feels that, well, she has a son who is very gifted, my stepbrother at MIT, he's in a highly visible position where whenever there's any scientific development in his area, which is artificial intelligence, he's one of the founders of it, the newspapers, the Times always goes to him, the Washington Post and so on. So she doesn't understand why I don't get into the newspapers, which is her idea of recognition. Well, there's a kind of recognition, but it's not
right.
One that I have been looking for.
What is his name?
Marvin Minsky.
We'll have to look for his name in the Times.
Yeah, you'll find it periodically, and his photograph, because he's very quotable also.
I see.
Mean, he
that
comes
helps.
Out with beautiful things. He's done in artificial intelligence, obviously, you have to look at intelligence and how the brain works. And, he described the brain, he said, it's just a computer made of meat. Now, that's highly
that's
quotable. Yeah. And he's glib, but he's profound also. Mm-hmm. And, he's really, he's worthy of quoting, and he is the kind of leaders that don't come very often in a generation, so I don't blame the press for being, or his mother for
Dr. Wald,
yeah.
In your travels, your children accompanied you?
Well, our sons were born in Japan. They didn't accompany us there, but they accompanied us back. Yeah, they were Oak Ridge and then Pittsburgh, that's where they grew up.
You never took them to Russia or Germany?
No. I guess Canada was the only foreign country we went to. But after college, they went off on their own lives. Our son is too busy with his own life, his wife and child, and get in a plug for a new program that he just had his first section on NBC. It's called Now.
Oh, sure.
Brokaw. He's the producer for that. We just saw the first segment of his that was on it. That's Conan Collins, the one that is about to, I guess tonight, in fact, do the late show. David did a segment on him for this NBC magazine show, which was a rather interesting situation to be in. You know, looking at somebody that NBC is investing an awful lot of money in.
Is that Conan? Huh?
What is
know.
The last
he's
name?
Never
I
been
can.
On, in
he's got a thing. Yeah, if you get the Times, he's on the op-ed page.
Oh, is he today?
Yeah, he did a
Good.
Review of his program in advance and gave it a panning. He's a character. David was, you know, in the situation where unless he gave him a real boost, the publicity people at NBC would be unhappy, and if he did depart from reality, then the Brokaw and company would be unhappy, so it was sort of a tightrope. I thought he did very well with it.
Is he aware of your work? Are you aware of all the things you have accomplished?
Well, he knows when I'm, you know, going out of the country at the request of the Russian government and things like that. I suppose he's more concerned with his own career at this point.
How old is he now?
55. 38, yeah.